time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquids simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink-in feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined today by John Finkel, the author of 1996, a biography, Reliving the Legend-Packed, Dynasty-Stacked, Most Iconic Sports Year Ever. John is the author of Hoops Heist, The Life of Dad, The Athlete, Heart Over Height, Mean Joe Green, and more. He's written for GQ, Men's Health, Yahoo Sports, and The New York Times. He lives in South Florida with his wife and two kids. Thank you for being on the show today, John.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
So this is not a sports show. This is a movie show. And the reason we have you on the show today is to talk about the year in sports movies in 1996 and kind of sports and movies more generally. I'm curious to get your take as somebody who has interacted with a lot of athletes and athlete adjacent types, and what they think of sports movies and kind of the depiction of sports on the big screen. But let's talk about 1996 first. This is a very weird year because we have the last two great golf movies, both came out in this year.
Yeah, two of the holy trinity of golf movies came out in 1996. It's one of those years where when I looked at the original idea, you know, as a writer, you kind of just have these notebooks open, I'm sure you have them, where you just jot down ideas, and some of them under like these umbrellas end up having more and more large, the umbrella gets larger and the ideas come together. And for me, like the athletes that, you know, had big years and came to fruition in 1996 were huge. But for me, as a movie buff and all that, as I'm going through it, I start remembering all the movies that were kind of out in my brain. You know, you sort of like, did that come out around 96? And is it 96? And then as you get closer, you start realizing, like, I'm listing all the movies that came out in 1996, right? And so when I start really thinking about them, I realize, like, this is like a quintessential movie year as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's so the two movies in question, of course, are Happy Gilmore, the Adam Sandler comedy, and Tin Cup, the Kevin Costner drama, sports drama, romantic comedy, I think we could call it.
Yeah.
And I have my personal connection to Tin Cup is that I worked for a summer on a golf course, basically in a pro shop, you know, as the assistant to the assistant pros, right? And right. That movie was on a loop. Tin Cup was always on. It was just like the thing that was on in the pro shop that people would come in and watch like 10 minutes of and leave before they hit back out on the course. It is weirdly the most accurate depiction of golf life I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's funny when you look back on it. When I think of Tin Cup and Happy Gilmore together, one of the things that I've said is like, if I just told you now, like next year, we're going to do two golf movies, and they're going to have these following A-listers in them, you know, Kevin Costner and Rene Russo and Adam Sandler and Cheech Marin. And just for fun, we're going to throw in Don Johnson and Carl Weathers. And like, as you're going through this, you think, what? What are these movies? How would they throw golf into them, right? And I think the reason Tin Cup worked is because, you know, Costner, natural athlete, you know, for the love of the game, Bull Durham, like he looks like an athlete. He looks like the kind of the best version of these athletes. His swing was legitimate. You know, he went and practiced. I don't think he got down to be a scratch golfer, but he worked with Corey Pavin and other PGA players to get on there. But because it was just that feel, he was the underdog. He looked and felt like the guy that if any of the duffers out who golf on the weekends managed to have that run where they maybe got to the PGA Tour, he looked and felt like what we all felt like we might feel if we made it onto the tour.
Yeah. And then, of course, the flip side of the coin here is Happy Gilmore, which is very, it's the least realistic golf movie in a lot of ways. But I think it's also kind of beloved by golfers, is it not? I mean, I know as somebody, again, who has spent some time on golf courses, I feel like it is a movie that is generally well liked.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quote. I think if you go to the quotes, if you do like and I did this when I wrote the book, like if you line the quotes up from, you know, Caddyshack, which is probably still just the go-to number one, but like you said, the Holy Trinity is Caddyshack, Happy Gilmore, and Tin Cup. If you go quote for quote, Happy Gilmore is right there. Go to your home, you know, go by the bay, like all the Shooter McGavin lines that he says. If you go and line them up and think of the things he says, it's like round for round, punch for punch with Caddyshack. I think it's just Caddyshack's been around longer, but I think the demo, right, of the guys who grew up watching it, 96, high school, college guys, who now actually maybe have time to golf and their kids are old enough where you can get out a little more than you'd like. Happy Gilmore is our movie, right? Like Caddyshack, the first time I saw it was, you know, slapstick humor from when I was 7 or 8. And and I didn't realize, it's like my dad and my uncle and the older generation of my family were like planting Easter eggs for all the Caddyshack lines. I didn't realize I was in college watching it again, that half the lines, you know, oh, it looks good on you though, those were Caddyshack lines, right? I didn't know that at the time because, you know, as adults, we just kind of quote our favorite movies. And then later on, when you're in your 20s, you're watching a movie and you're like, oh, my uncle wasn't that funny. He's just doing every Rodney Dangerfield line from Caddyshack.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. So let's see. We've also got in 1996, The Fan, which I think we could say that's the worst of these movies.
We could say that, or we could say it's the best.
We'll get to the one that I think is actually the worst here in a minute. But the fan, I remember seeing The Fan, not in theaters, when it was like first out on, you know, DVD or VHS or whatever, I guess, in 1997 when it hit Blockbuster shelves, and thinking, okay, well, this isn't actually a baseball movie. Like, that's the problem with this movie, is that it's not actually a baseball movie. It's a movie about a fan. It's a movie about stalking. And as such, that's why it doesn't really work, right?
I am like the last defender of The Fan. Okay, I remember this. I saw the theater. I remember in the trailer they had De Niro's character like on the mound, it's raining, Wesley Snipes is up, but they don't tell you what's happening. And I'm like, well, that I'm seeing that. Okay, I'm in for this no matter what's happening. And then in the theater, it just gets more and more absurd. You're correct. It is not a baseball movie, except for that 80% of the movie takes place in a baseball diamond with somebody wearing a baseball uniform talking about baseball. And to me, especially as a dad, I watched it again, well, obviously when I was researching this movie. And there's a scene in this movie, which you're a dad, I know, you'll understand this. They really ratchet up, like, you know, De Niro's character is, for those who don't know, like the most psychotic Giants fan ever. His team trades for, at the time, like a Barry Bonds stand-in. His next character's named Bobby Rayburn. He's played by, you know, Willie Mays Hayes, Wesley Snipes. Super duper star, gets there. It's a huge deal. Now, De Niro takes his kid to the game, he and his wife are divorced. He's a psycho. Like, he's shown hints in the movie of him already being a psycho. At this game, he's under fire at work. He's a knife salesman, of all things, and he has to go. His boss calls him right before he goes. He's got to go to a pageant presentation for work. And he leaves his, like, 9-year-old at the stadium and, like, rushes out and is like, here's a hot dog, here's a drink, I'll be right back. And dude, as a dad, the anxiety there of him just like walking away from, you know, walking out of a packed Candlestick Park at the time with his 9-year-old, like almost in tears in the stands. I couldn't watch it. Like, I couldn't believe how psycho this guy was. So you're right. It's a more psycho movie. But once you get to that level of how crazy this guy is, the baseball craziness stuff, because there's like a call-in sports show that he calls into. He gets involved with the agent with, you know, John Leguizamo. Like, it's all in on the baseball universe.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is weird. Like, the sports is kind of inherently cinematic in a way, right? You've got your heels and your faces, right? You've got your good guys, your bad guys. You've got your winners and losers. I mean, it is a sports game. Is in its own way its own little story, and that is one reason why they get turned into things like Space Jam, which is the worst movie in this book. I lied. Not The Fan. Space Jam. Now, I am one of these people who looks at my generation of, you know, the millennials and just scratches my head every time Space Jam comes up as like a touchstone film. It is treated as like basically the Caddyshack of people, you know, my age and a little younger. explain to me why I'm wrong, because I get the sense from reading your book that you like it a little more than I do.
Well, I'm going to say this. So I was 18 when Space Jam came out. So I was like, oh, cartoons are lame, you know, kind of that age. But in order to understand the context of why this is important, you have to be right at the moment of where Michael Jordan was a god. He was the closest thing you were going to ever see to a god. He was the most popular, charismatic, exciting athlete we ever had. And leading into Space Jam, and this is why I'm going to tell you Space Jam is actually brilliant, more brilliant than you think it is, an execution. I'm not saying the screenplay, but an execution. So leading into the Space Jam, Michael Jordan left. No one had ever done this. No one knew why at the time. His dad passed away. He wins the title. He used to go play baseball. So, like, there is no equivalent of this in baseball now. There's nobody even close in basketball. Maybe, I don't even know. Steph Curry's already too old. Like, the number one athlete of the world, basically, leaves his best sport to go play minor league baseball. So he disappears. He comes back in late 1995 for a ill-fated playoff run with the Bulls. And then that next year, he comes in 96, you know, through 95 into 96 and has the 17-10. Everybody saw the Last Dance season, wins the championship. He's back on top. Jordan's back on top, you know, starts the season the next year. Can he repeat? Can he do all this stuff? And in the winter of that, in that holiday season, Space Jam comes out. The reason Space Jam resonates so well is because they took the plot of Jordan's real life, whether or not he loved basketball, why he lost the love of basketball, and worked it into the open of the movie. He's playing baseball. The movie opens where they need to steal an item from his room. And why isn't he playing basketball? Will he play basketball? The guys are trying to get him to play basketball. And then obviously with Toontown, everything happens and they need to get Michael Jordan to go play for them. But he hasn't played. Like, we just saw him play. And they worked his real biography all the way from UNC to the Bulls to the Birmingham Barons into the movie. And so whether or not it's a great movie or not, I think the real issue is that's why we all connected with it. We grew up with Jordan being amazing. We were flummoxed when he went to play baseball. We were the tunes basically in this movie. Like, come on, Mike, come play with us, come play with us. And then it was our beloved cartoon characters growing up, Bugs and Daffy and all those characters. So that's why it's beloved. I can't argue whether it's a great movie. It's clearly all over the place. The script was rewritten daily as they were doing it. On the sports side, I can tell you some stories about why it was, it's become mythical in the filming of it. But you had Bill Murray, you had Larry Bird, you had Bugsy Bogues, you had Patrick Ewing, you had all these guys. You had Charles Barkley, losing their basketball powers and being doofuses on the court. But really, the appeal is really an emotional one, I think.
Yeah. No, it's certainly, look, nostalgia is a hell of a drug, so I'm not gonna take away people's nostalgia. Let's talk a little bit about some of the stories about Space Jam, because it is an interesting confluence, again, of sports and Hollywood and the business of all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason that Space Jam exists is because somebody was like, all right, let's synergize here. Let's get basketball and Hollywood together and make something, that combines the two most popular things in America right now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
and some of the stories about the athletes who were just like showing up at this, basically on set to like play pickup ball.
Yeah, that's the coolest part. I'll get into that in a second. One of the reason the movie came about is because there was a commercial that Nike did with Air Jordan, obviously Michael Jordan, and Hair Jordan, Bugs Bunny, where they were playing basketball and it was almost like, I'm sure somebody said this is a test case for a movie, but in the beginning it was just a cool mashup between an athlete and, probably behind Mickey Mouse, maybe Bugs is top five cartoon character, we'll call it.
Sure,
if we're ready.
Sure.
We're not gonna diss Bugs. And the commercial was a hit. And so, we'd already seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit, so there was a playbook for how to get the real life and animation together. And they basically came up with this idea of what if this became an animated movie? And could we sustain this could we have a reason, a plot to do this? And could we sustain it? And so one of my favorite little anecdotes I uncovered when I was writing it was they didn't even know what to call it. They had no idea. They basically were calling it Bugs Bunny Michael Jordan movie or one of the other Warner Brothers. Yeah. And there's a great anecdote in one of the oral histories that I found where so they were around the room. They're trying to figure out how they're going to market this. They're behind on the script. They're behind on everything. They didn't have a title. Our marketing team's like, we need a title. We can't even do anything about announcing this without a title. And so they wrote when they were putting the meeting together on the cover of the script, they just wrote Up in the Air. The title's Up in the Air. We don't know yet, right? So the secretary gets the copy, and she's been under the gun from the marketing team to like spread, you know, disseminate the information. So she goes out and puts out a company-wide announcement. You know, thankfully, no one's going to bother me anymore. We have a title. It's called Up in the Air. Here's the movie. Here's what we're going to go through. So everybody walks into the meeting, and half the people are relieved. Great. Up in the Air makes total sense. Great title. Jordan flies, Air Jordan, blah, blah, blah. And then one of the bigwigs comes out and goes, no, you morons. The title, we were saying that the title itself is Up in the Air. We don't know. Not that the title is Up in the Air. So they literally were moving along on this movie with no idea what to call it or how to market it.
Oh, that's great. That's a very classic Hollywood story. And then on set, of course, they built essentially a little mini stadium for Jordan.
Yeah, it was really cool. So everybody, you know, people who are listening who are basketball fans, they had the bubble last year, right, that they did for the quarantine, and they played the NBA playoffs in a bubble. But the first actual basketball NBA bubble was built for Michael Jordan on the Warner Brothers lot. So they filmed it in the summer. They filmed it obviously in his off season. His stipulations were basically, I'll do whatever you need. You have me for, I think the shoot was 2 months or 2.5 months, whatever it was, over the summer. But I need a court, I need a gym, and I need easy access to it. I don't want to be sitting in LA traffic. I don't want to be driving around. Like, it's got to be on the lot. So they took over this giant parking space area, built one of those, like, you know, air tent bubbles over it, put a full weight room along one side, a full court and a half on the other side. And basically Jordan was just taking his golf cart between the golf course, which we all know he golfs, you know, a ton, the shoot, you know, soundstage, and then the bubble. And this bubble became, you know, if it was now, there would have been a show called The Bubble with social media and pickup games and all that. But why I think it's grown in the mythology in the sports world is because for that summer, it was basically like an all-star game every single night. You had all the cast of the movie who were in it, Patrick Ewing and Charles Barkley and Muggsy Bogues and Larry Johnson playing with Jordan. But then all the young UCLA players, you know, you had Reggie Miller there, Dennis Rodman showed up, Pippen came down, you know, Barkley had brought his friends down, you know, Juwan Howard, all these guys who were in the league coming down to play with Jordan. And there were these epic, epic battles that would go all the way into night. And the most kind of mythic night ever there is when, you know, Magic Johnson also had his comeback in 96 from his hiatus for having HIV. And there had been rumored that he was going to come back at some point in time. And while they were filming the movie, he was actually part owner of the Lakers, which meant he was not allowed under the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, to really have any kind of interaction with the players during the offseason. So when he decides he's going to come back, he kind of resigns his ownership stake and shows up. And has like this 4-hour battle leading, you know, his team against Jordan's teams, almost like those Dream Team mythical games. And so this bubble became like, if you look back and a lot of the NBA beat guys that I interviewed who were there, like the stories are endless of what went on there. And it was one of those things that there's no video. All there are is just sort of the apocryphal Bigfoot type tales of the games that went on there.
Yeah, it's funny to think about like that existing in modern day with cell phones and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine the TikToks?
Yeah, right. Oh, the guys would show up with their marketing teams. Let's make sure we get a one-on-one with, you know, Steph and LeBron, or let's make sure Kevin Durant and Kyrie do this together. Or, hey, why don't you guys play 2-on-2? It'd be good for the camera. Apparently these games, you know, because Jordan, the way he was, you know, they were around his shoot schedule. So, you know, there were some nights he might wrap, 10, 11 p.m. And these games might go from 12 to 4 in the morning. It was like there was no there was only like a very loose invite list. You had to know how to get there. You know, he had to let you on the lot so you couldn't just kind of show up. And it was really, really cool. And the fact that they did this, like you said, under the total cloak of, you know, basically like there was a stealth NBA game happening, you know, where at some point they said a third of the NBA All-Stars were in L.A. at one time playing in Jordan's pickup games. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. So then let's get to the last movie of 1996 that you highlight here, Jerry Maguire. Jerry Maguire is, I think, just the best of these, just on a pure filmmaking level.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's also, you know, the movie that kind of best gets at the business of sports. I don't think I've ever seen a movie that has quite understood the business side of sports as well as this. And you, in the book, talk a bit about meeting with Drew Rosenhaus.
Yeah.
And doing wind sprints until you wanted to throw up. But what did he make of the film and kind of how that portrayed his side of the sports business?
Yeah, I don't know. I hung out with Drew that time, and I've had a few interactions with him by interviewing his athletes. So we're by no means buddies or pals or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But he at the time, like, he embraced it. Once Jerry Maguire became a big hit, obviously, why would you not embrace, you know, him and Lee Steinberg? They kind of casually both say they were based on Jerry Maguire, and it's both true. You know, Cameron Crowe has come out and said it was maybe a little more Lee Steinberg. They didn't actually base it on anybody. There was a picture a long time earlier about Brian Bosworth and his agent, and that was where you know, they looked at that picture, James L. Brooks, and you know, that's like that mythology behind that movie was like they looked at the picture and they thought, what is this relationship like? You've got this hot shot, the biggest player in college football coming out. He's relying on this guy to navigate this multi-million dollar world. How do they trust each other? So that's what it came about. From Drew's perspective, I will say, like, he prides himself on having essentially a familial relationship with his athletes. He said it. One of the great stories that we talked about was, so yeah, I did, the story I did was a day in the life type of thing. And it was for Muscle and Fitness at the time, and I'm a bit of a meathead, so I was like, yeah, if you're going to work out, I'll work out with you. I'll do whatever. He did. He ran. We went out to this high school in Coral Gables where he lived, you know, near where he lived. It's Florida. It's summer. 90 degrees on the field, sweating at 6 o'clock in the morning. We're running wind sprints. He's got both, like, truly, whether he did it for the shoot or not, he had two phones on him and assistant holding another phone. Yeah. And he's like, he's got them divided up on who knows what numbers, however he had it. And we're blasting through the things, and he's telling me, listen, I could get to know my clients just like all the other agents. We could go to a steakhouse. We could have drinks. But I get to know them right here, and they get to know me. These guys, their body is their career, how hard they work. And they want to see an agent who's going to come out here and sweat with them and do this with them at 6 in the morning way more than a guy who's just going to put together a presentation and take them out to a steak dinner. He's like, yeah, there's steaks. Yeah, there's drinks. Yeah, there's a fancy part of it, of course. But this is why I work out with the guys. This is where we get to know each other. When we're pushing through the last set of gassers in the morning or push-ups, we're in the weight room. And he was absolutely sincere because every athlete I talked to was like, oh, hell yeah, they all have their workout with Drew. I was in town, went to the gym, went and played basketball. And I'm sure other agents do versions of this of themselves and all that kind of stuff. But for me, when I was talking to him about it, I thought it was genuine. He embraced it. And so when you talk about in Jerry Maguire, the, you know, the show me the Quan, all that stuff, like when they became family – he was very much about that.
Yeah. You've spent a lot of time talking to athletes and interviewing them for books, stories, whatever. I'm curious if A, the subject of movies and sports ever comes up, and B, what their take on how the film industry portrays what they do, what that take is. I mean, I assume that they have minor complaints like, well, it doesn't look like he can actually play. Or other things, but I'm curious what their POV on it is.
Yeah, that's the first one you just said is like they love when an actor's cast who can do it. So the best example is Michael B. Jordan, Creed 2. Like I've talked to a lot of athletes about that, mainly from the training side because the soundtrack's good and all that. But like they love when the actor can ball or can box or can do it, and when you really go all out for it, and you know, some of the movies it's hard to show that, and on, you know, on the football side, you know, they're with the Ballers and some of these shows, like when you can get an actor who, you know, like, you know, John, you know, Denzel's son, you know, John D. Washington, like he played college, you know, he played college football, like, so when you get these guys who actually played and then they can act, there's a lot of respect there. I think the two big areas that I've seen athletes and really sports fans in general mock is the throwing motion. When they cast a quarterback who cannot throw or a pitcher who cannot throw, it's awful. It's so awful. It's like it takes you completely out of everything going on. And, you know, there's that famous story for Any Given Sunday where, like, you know, Puff Daddy was supposed to be the, you know, the Jamie Foxx character.
Yeah, yeah.
But he couldn't throw a football. And, like, he's denied it to this day. But almost all of the non-famous people on that set were like, look, you can't – dude couldn't throw a football 15 yards. He looked like a clown. Jamie Foxx played high school football. He's a natural athlete. He looked great playing it. And I honestly think that's the key. They don't even care about the athlete. If you represent the sport well, then you can pass it off. But that's it. They want legitimacy. They want to try. They want to at least try. From what I've seen in the few – I'm not going to put any, you know, athletes that I've talked to about. But I know several of the basketball guys that I've talked to even recently when I was writing Hoops Heist, because Creed 2 had come out when I started doing the interviews. And I had talked to the trainer for that, for Michael B. Jordan, and it came up a few different times. And he's friends with a lot of these dudes, but that was it. The legitimacy of being able to do the deed.
Yeah. Michael B. Jordan also, like, he was on Friday Night Lights, right? The TV show. Yeah. And then Creed, obviously. But he also just looks like an athlete. I mean, he's huge. He's like the movie Without Remorse that's out now is not very good. But there's this great scene where he is like getting ready to fight a bunch of guards.
I love that scene,
And he's just like big, and he's like wrapping up his knuckles. And I'm like, okay, I actually buy this. I buy him taking on this whole.
Aside from the fact that he lost no muscle mass after being shot and bedridden for 5 months. But we'll pass
That's movie magic. That's movie. We'll just chalk that up to movie magic. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Okay.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. I've got some quick quizzes.
Sure.
Field of Dreams versus Bull Durham.
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. Now, Bull Durham is one of those ones where the if I remember correctly, it's been a while since I watched, but Tim Robbins looked like he could not throw a baseball.
That is the big knock on
him. Am I wrong?
No, you're 100% correct. He cannot throw a baseball at all. His elbow, and I mean, I'm not even like a big baseball nerd arm position thing. He just, I mean, my son would look and be like, what's wrong with his arm? It looks like his arm hurts or it's broken or something. I'll ride with Field of Dreams. The connection, the sentiment, the chills you get, that's always going to be up there for me. Bull Durham, I'll be honest, it's okay. I've never loved Bull Durham. It's never been one of my go-to movies. I don't even think it's that good.
I never have either. I'll be honest. I think it's fine. I am definitely like Field of Dreams is like top five dad movie.
Yeah,
that's
Bull
just
okay.
That's just what it
Field
is.
Field Dreams is
Bull Durham's fine. All right, moving to kids. Sandlot versus Bad News Bears.
Sandlot.
See, this is a function, I think, of our age. I mean, you're a couple years older than me, but I was like 12 when Sandlot came out. Definitely a seminal film. For folks around our age here.
Sandlot, the beauty of Sandlot, I think your kids are younger than mine. Mine are, my son's eight. Like, the Sandlot has that thing that, I remember Harold Ramis said it about Groundhog Day, where they completely intentionally removed all pop culture references. They removed anything that could date the movie whatsoever, consciously. They wanted it to be the kind of movie that at any given time could watch, and there was no need to know about what was happening in the pop culture or larger culture world. You could just watch it. And that's what The Sandlot is. In a world where our kids come home and they want to play an iPad and they want to go on Roblox and they want to do all this technical stuff, my son can sit down and be mesmerized by Benny the Jet, you know, by Ham. The jokes work. I mean, I guess probably now some people have a problem if you play ball like a girl, but like the jokes by and large work all the way through. The coming of age stuff, the Wendy Peppercorn thing with the getting the kid, like Smalls, like the nicknames, the fun loving, the ribbing the kids at the neighbor, you know, the next door, the kids from the other neighborhood who they have a rivalry against. Like, it all worked. It worked when I was 12. It worked when I was 20, and it works for my kid who's 9. And that's why I think it's better.
Yeah, it is. It's great. I mean, Bad News Bears is also very good.
Yeah.
I don't want to drag Bad News Bears here, but I agree. Sandlot better. All right. Moving to basketball, Blue Chips versus Hoosiers.
I'm gonna go with Blue Chips.
Wow.
I know.
Wow, that's a shocker. That's an upset.
I have this thing. I have always had this thing, and I don't know if you're going to get to football next, but like some of these giant, like mythical movies that I'm supposed to have loved that came out a little before I was old enough to really see them. I didn't see them in theater. I saw them on back, you know, HBO, or maybe you saw them Blockbuster. Like, hey, we got to watch Hoosiers. Whether I'm having a natural like reaction against the movie, like it's good. The scenes that are supposed to be amazing are amazing. I think it's a little slow. I think there's a really weird, like, the Gene Hackman, the woman, the love interest who's not a love interest is bizarre. The basketball's stilted. It's okay, a bunch of white kids and whatever. Blue Chips is, like, my movie. This is Shaq, Neon Bordeaux, like, Penny Hardaway, like, Nick Nolte screaming and exactly like a pseudo-UCLA. Like, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who will say Hoosiers, but if I said, okay, great, you are forced to sit in this room right now and you have to either watch Blue Chips or Hoosiers, they pick Blue Chips. And I think Hoosiers is like a fake movie to say you like more.
Wow, that is
shocking
turn of events here on Bulwark Goes Hollywood. All right, one last, we're going to do a football, Any Given Sunday versus The Longest Yard.
Oh, thank you for saying
either Longest Yard. I'll go with Sandler or Reynolds.
Okay,
you can pick which one you prefer.
I like the Sandler Longest Yard. I don't think it was bad. I thought Nelly was good. Michael Irvin was good. If they took out, as much as I love everything Sandler, if they took out some of the Sandler bits and just made it the movie with real Sandler, I think it would have been better. But Any Given Sunday is my all-time. I mean, The program's really good because that was I was in high school playing high school football when the program came out. But Any Given Sunday, I mean, the 6 inches in front, I could do the whole speech of Pacino's. Yeah. Like, that's better. And thank you, by the way, for leaving Rudy, like the worst sports movie ever, off this list. I don't even understand people who like that movie. But yeah, Any Given Sunday's at the top.
I like Rudy fine. I like Rudy's a fine movie.
Okay, I'll say it's
heartwarming. We're not going to drag Rudy on this show. I'll let you drag Hoosiers.
Okay.
But,
okay. I get one drag. I'll do that. Okay. I'll leave that as
All right. Well, the bonus, because you mentioned Sandler, Longest Yard versus The Waterboy.
Oh, Waterboy. I mean, Waterboy is so good. Well, you know what's funny about The Waterboy? It's really short. Like, it goes by like very fast. Like, if you put it on and then maybe like go make some popcorn and like fix something in the other room and come back, like you're already like at the part where he's like maybe not able to play because his mom found out that he's playing. It's really funny and it's fast and it's easy. And it's like an homage to the Three Stooges. It's all slapstick. Like, again, I bring up my kids because I end up watching so many, so many times I'm thinking I want to sit down and watch a movie. And it's like, oh, well, you're going to watch it with me. Hey, you haven't seen Waterboy yet. We'll watch this. You haven't seen Sandlot yet. We'll watch this. So Waterboy kills. Like, it's just funny. Yeah. The hits are funny. The jokes are funny. I'm going Waterboy.
It's funny. It's a funny movie. It's Adam Sandler, one of our underrated sports actors.
Absolutely. And he always works like basketball scenes into his movies and, the t-shirts, a zillion sports t-shirts. And
Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems is basically a sports movie.
Yeah, basically he gets Garnett in there. I know it was supposed to be, I think, Amari Stoudemire. First, and then he's got all of his movies work around these cool basketball scenes and baseball scenes, and he's the most regular dude who made it, so that's why we love him.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, John. I really appreciate it. The name of the book, again, 1996, a biography, reliving the legend-packed, dynasty-stacked, most iconic sports year ever. The book is not all about movies. You should, if you remember that great sports year, you should definitely check it out, because there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there, from the Olympics to
Rock
Jordan's
and Stone
return,
Cold, yeah.
And the Rock and Stone Cold. We haven't even talked wrestling. Who's the best wrestling actor? Go.
Best wrestling actor. Man, it's probably the Rock right now.
Probably the Rock. But Thunder Lips, aka Hulk Hogan. You know, we don't want to.
Well, you know, Hogan has. And I'm blanking on the name of the movie. He did his own movie where it was him against Tiny Lister. Remember that movie? Where he basically plays a version of himself. I'm killing myself for not remembering it.
Yeah.
He plays Hogan. Rock has moved beyond like just playing a wrestler, dude. He's figured it all out. Now we have John Cena in the new Fast and Furious. Yeah. We'll see. My kids love Stephen.
John Cena's tried to make the leap into action comedy.
Yeah.
And has done it a little better than I think The Rock, who's a more pure action star.
Yeah.
But Cena's in the new Suicide Squad. Yeah. He was in that Amy Schumer movie.
He was
Trainwreck.
Funny,
very
in that
funny
movie.
In that.
Yeah, I think he's good. He did a kids movie where he plays a firefighter, the fire down below or fire above. That was the heavy laundry.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was good. It was passable. Like, it was okay. Yeah. He was fine.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for being on the show. Buy the book. It's on Amazon now. It's out now. It was out 2 days ago. Go pick it up. And read all about the year of 1996 in sports and sports movies. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. We will be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.